Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Kwok Ting test when we come back. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of my two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. And this school includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you're served with a summons, a citation, or a complaint. Now, rule number one is don't say anything, keep your mouth shut, and shut up. Now, if you can learn rule one, you can win about 90% of your legal cases. And that's because all of the evidence that's ever going to be used against you is going to be furnished by you, and your government is fully capable of making their own case without any help from you whatsoever. So don't give the prosecution their victory. Make them work for it. Now listen to what the courts have to say about keeping quiet in the face of police interrogation, or in some cases, police intimidation. One judge put it this way. He said, "Who would believe the ironic truth that the cooperative taxpayer fares much worse than the individual who relies upon his constitutional rights?" And he said that in U.S. versus Dickerson. The second judge put it this way. He said, "You can and you must keep your mouth shut for protection under the Fifth Amendment." And he said that in Belknap versus United States. The third judge said this. He said, "The constitutional privilege was intended to shield the guilty and the imprudent, as well as the innocent and farsighted." And he said that in Marchetti versus United States. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, call us here at the law school. Remember the number, 417-273-4967. Now, once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law school. It's the place to start. It's entertaining. It's educational. It's informative. Best of all, it's free. Our school, Courtroom Strategy and Procedure, is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can just go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Now, once more, that's georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about the Kwok Ting test. Now, Kwok Ting was a Chinese immigrant from China, landed in San Francisco, said that he'd been born in San Francisco, left at age 10, been gone to China for 6 years. Here's a 16-year-old boy. And there's a 3-part test, remember? Your testimony has to be complete. The testimony must contain some extemporaneous detail. And number 3, your testimony must be supported by witnesses and evidence. So, using that test, which came out in 1891, which was an extrapolation from a number of cases that had occurred over a long period of time, the judicial system here in America, and indeed in Anglo-Saxon administration around the world, has over a long period of time worked out the details on how to tell the truth. That is, how can we tell? How can we be sure that what you say is true? Now, in 1918, Professor Swift at George Washington University came up with a startling new revelation, and that is 25% of everything that comes out of our mouth is false. That doesn't mean that you're lying intentionally. It means that your perception of what happened is erroneous. And I told you a couple of stories, like the Earl Sherman story, where the Delta truck we thought, hit the back of our car, when in fact it wasn't the Delta truck, it was the green and red ONC truck. And we've discussed the 30% of convictions for rape being bogus. And yet, these women point their finger at the defendant there at the defendant's table and say, that is the man that raped me. Well, the good news is 70% of the time they're right, and the bad news is that 30% of the time they're wrong. And so 30% of the people locked up in our prisons today for rape are there on bogus charges. They didn't do it. Now, it's important for us then as witnesses to give the truth, the true account when we're witnesses on the witness stand. And so I pointed out to you that our job is to tell what we know, what we heard, and what we saw. And so in the Professor Swift case, if you'll remember, the testimony would have had to have been, yes, I saw the man shot with a banana. What? What? You expect us to believe he was shot with a banana? Yes, sir, that's what I saw. And based upon the evidence, that is, you smelled the cordite, you heard the shot, you heard the victim cry out, I've been shot, you saw him carried out of the room, as far as you know, what you saw was that the man was shot with a banana. And that should be your testimony. Because that's the truth. But we draw conclusions. We come to a conclusion that, well, I couldn't have seen this guy shot with a banana. So therefore, I can't tell the story that I think I saw because it's incredible. It's incredulous. Nobody would believe it. And so one witness said it was the shot from a .32 Smith & Wesson revolver. Well, no, it wasn't. There was no Smith & Wesson revolver there. That's the power of suggestion. And this power of suggestion is very powerful. So I pointed out in one of the stories here where the man raised his arm above his head upon the quiet suggestion that he do so. So there are 23 of these techniques, 23 of these modes or modalities that we use in our cross-examination to bring out the truth, and in some cases it can be from a witness that is deliberately lying, or it can be from a witness that thinks or believes that he's telling the truth, but in reality it isn't. Now there is an interesting case here. It's called the Henry E. Lazarus case. It came out about 1918 during World War I. And Henry E. Lazarus was a prominent merchant in the city of New York, and he was indicted a few years ago by the federal grand jury, and he was charged with the offense of bribing a United States officer and violation of the Sabotage Act. But he was honorably acquitted by a jury after a 30-minute deliberation. Now, it was during the height of the war, and Mr. Lazarus was a very large manufacturer of rubber coats, and he had manufactured hundreds of thousands of these rubber coats for the government under contract. The government, for its protection, employed large numbers of inspectors. And in the heat and excitement of war times, these inspectors occasionally tried to make good. And one of these efforts resulted in the indictment of Mr. Lazarus. Now, the chief witness against Lazarus was a man named Charles L. Fuller. Fuller was the supervising inspector attached to the Depot Quartermaster's office in New York City. Fuller testified that Lazarus gave money to him to influence him in regard to his general duties as an inspector, and that he was to overlook the fact that Lazarus was manufacturing defective coats and thereby violating the Sabotage Act. Now, that's pretty tough to overcome. Think about this for a moment. You're in court, and then the policeman comes in and testifies that you offered him a bribe. Now, oftentimes, people will say to me, you know, shake their heads and say, oh, God, there's just no way out of that. And that's because people believe that policemen always tell the truth. And the truth of the matter is, policemen lie 25% of the time, just like all the rest of us. Their memory isn't any better than yours or mine. Now, there is one thing that the policeman does that gives him the edge and gives him the appearance of credibility, which is greater than the average layperson, and that's because he's trained to always write down the events that transpired leading up to the event itself and then what happened afterward. For instance, when you're driving down the road and the lights come on, the policeman stops you, he comes up to your window and he says, "I'm going to write you a ticket for speeding." He goes back to his car, he sits there for a few minutes and he writes out a ticket. He comes back and he says, "Here, sign here." And you sign the ticket. He gives you a copy of it. "Thank you very much." And then he goes back to his car. Now you take the ticket, stick it up in your sun visor, and you start off down the road again. Now you look in your rearview mirror and the policeman isn't following you. And as you drive down the road a half a mile, you look in the rearview mirror and there he is, still sitting alongside the road. And that should raise a question in your mind. Well, what is he doing there? He's writing up a report. He's writing up a report. And in his report, he's putting in such details as milepost 381, highway 60, that it was a clear day, or that it was raining. And he puts in these details because he's trained to. Why? Well, because this case may go to court, may go to trial. And he may have to come back later and testify to these facts. Well, what kind of weather was it that day? Well, it was raining that day. And where did this occur? Well, it occurred about milepost 381. What highway was this? It was Highway 60. Now, when you come in, you don't have any such report. And so when the policeman is reading from his report, the police report, it makes it look like, hey, this guy's on top of his game. This guy knows what he's talking about. Now, it's certainly true that his report is going to be much more accurate than your memory of the event 6 months ago, or a year ago, or for that matter, 3 days ago. And that's why it's important to debrief. That's why it's important that you write down these events. So when I get a ticket, and the policeman gives me a ticket, I sit there and start writing my report. And I've had policemen, you know, come up to me after they've written their report and say, is there something wrong, Mr. Gordon? No, I'm just writing a report. When we go to trial, you'll have your report and I'll have mine. And it's really unnerving. The policeman, you know, will look at you like, what? What? You are writing a report of what just happened? Oh, yeah. I've got your name, and I've got your car number, and I've got the weather, and the date, and time, place, and facts, witnesses, and evidence. Got them right here. I'm ready to testify. Just like you. All right. Now, the purpose for that isn't because I'm trying to intimidate somebody, but because I know, I don't know if the policeman's got an accurate report. We would presume he does. But I've seen times when policemen came in and testified inaccurately. Whether they did it on purpose or not, you know, a matter of subjection. I don't know. Did he lie on purpose? Maybe. Did he lie accidentally? Probably. Is his story going to be 100% accurate? No, it's going to be 75% true, accurate, and correct, and 25% false, just like mine. Just like yours and everybody else's. Now, this guy Fuller comes in and testifies against Lazarus. He gets right up there on the witness stand, swears, you know, "I swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth." He says, "This guy Lazarus over here offered me bribes." Now, that's a direct lie. He either knew that he received a bribe or was offered a bribe or he didn't. Oftentimes, when people lie, it's a mistake that they make based upon faulty observation, like being shot with a banana. This isn't a mistake. This is a direct perjured statement. And this direct perjured statement is going to put this guy Lazarus in prison unless Lazarus can uncover this lie. All right, so let's go on. Well, Martin W. Littleton acted as chief counsel for the defense, and he was fully appreciative of Mr. Lazarus's high character and of his conscientious discharge of his duties in the manufacture of the material for the government. And he was also well informed as to the general character and history of Fuller. Now, after Fuller testified in chief that he was first questioned closely as to the time when he became an employee of the government. Now, counsel for the defense knew that he was required to make and sign and then swear to an application as to his prior experience. So a messenger had been sent to the government files to get the original of this application, signed by the witness, and came into court with the document in his hand just as counsel was putting the following question to the witness. So on cross-examination, just to set the stage for you, on cross-examination, Mr. Fuller is on the witness stand. Fuller is a government agent. He's just testified that Lazarus had paid him bribes. Now it's our turn to cross-examine this witness. Now, I've said it before, let me say it again. The worst thing that can happen to you is that the witness is telling the truth about you. Because there isn't any defense to somebody telling the truth about you. The best thing that can happen to you is that your opponent, in this case, Fuller, the government agent, is lying about you. Because if this guy gets on the witness stand and lies, we can uncover that on cross-examination. We can show that this guy is a liar. And we can show that through 23 vehicles. There are 23 ways for us to accomplish that goal. So let me run through this list of 23 ways that we're going to do this. And then we'll take a look at Lazarus, and we'll take a look at Fuller's testimony, and we'll see how Fuller's testimony is turned against him, and Lazarus is acquitted in 30 minutes. Watch. There are 23 ways that we go about this. In some cases, we use humor. Some cases we use details. It can be done on collateral matters, from memory. It may be an expose. It could be the use of a demonstration. We can do it by flattery. We can do it sometimes by confrontation, memorization, contradiction, inconsistencies, explanations, embarrassment, ridicule, the test, the hypothetical, overconfidence, by the use of many witnesses, by the use of the trump card, the high point, the silent cross, the eyewitnesses, the power of suggestion, friendly, impartial inquiry, and partisanship. 23 ways. Now remember the other day we talked about this thing. Remember the story of the young man from the livery stable? And it was suggested to him that he show the jury how high he could raise his arm since the accident. So with great, it was kind of like O.J. Simpson putting on the glove, you know, with great difficulty, he raised his arm to about, you know, level with the shoulder. And then the next quiet suggestion was, show us how high you could raise your same arm, your right arm, before the accident. So he raises it up over his head. Now, that's the power of suggestion. And that power of suggestion is very powerful. And that's all it took to win the case. This guy was claiming that he was permanently disabled, and now he raises his arm up over his head by a simple suggestion. Now, he did not know that. He was not trained in Wellman on cross-examination. And now you know that secret. That before you give an answer, you better be thinking about the power of suggestion. Now, this isn't an exercise in teaching you how to lie on the witness stand. Because you can rest assured that even if you're a Mark Furman, a trained police officer who knows many, if not all, of these techniques. F. Lee Bailey tripped him up using the same technique on collateral matters that's going to be used in this case against Lazarus. Now, collateral matters is the subject matter that we're going to use. It's the technique that you're observing here in this Lazarus story that's going to undo the lies of Fuller, the policeman who comes into court and testifies under oath and swears that he's telling the truth, but he's coming in here lying. Do policemen ever come into court and lie intentionally for the express purpose of convicting this guy? Oh, yeah, they do it every day. Do it every day. Do prosecutors coach policemen in lying on the witness stand in order to win a conviction? Oh, yeah, they do it every day. Every day. It's part and parcel with the system. And the system is designed, remember, it's not a justice system, it's an adversarial system. Now, God instructed us in Deuteronomy chapter 1, he says, I want you to practice just judgment. I want a justice system. And, you know, we woke up one day and said, nah, we don't want this justice system. Well, we want an adversarial system. All right, so whether you're using a justice system or an adversarial system, the outcome is identical. Our objective here is to show that this witness is lying. Now, if this witness is telling the truth, you're not going to use any of these techniques to harm him. You cannot get somebody in a contradictory position if he's telling the truth. But if this guy's lying and you know how to use these techniques, there isn't any way in hell this guy can get away with his lies. I don't care whether this is a policeman or the President of the United States. And sometimes I watch senators who are trained advocates also. And they're examining a witness. And this witness is not forthcoming. And the witness is lying to Congress. And I watch these senators, and sometimes I kind of shake my head and I say, well, where did this guy go to law school? This senator doesn't know how to ask questions. He doesn't know how to get behind this witness's lies. He does not know how to expose them. Now, you need to understand that some witnesses are very, very skillful liars. Like, let's take, for instance, Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, both trained attorneys, both wonderful liars. Both of them can lie beautifully. Well, that's because they were trained in law school to lie. They know how to do that. They know these 23 techniques. I saw this Gonzalez, the former attorney general, came into Congress. He was being asked, you know, about torture in Guantanamo Bay. He was marvelous, a marvelous witness. And this new attorney general, his name is Mukasey, he was also asked about waterboarding and torture. And remember, he's a federal judge. And Mukasey, now to those of us that are trained in law, we looked at Mukasey and said, well, he's being evasive. He's not answering the question. You know, he'd be asked a question, what's your mother's maiden name? And he would say that my grandmother eats Skippy peanut butter on whole wheat bread. He would never address, he would never answer the question. So I said, well, the problem here is, number one, you've got a witness who is a very skilled, trained, professional lawyer, a judge. He knows the Kwok-Ting test. And then you've got a senator up here who may be a very skilled litigator, but he's not asking the right questions. He's not asking the question that gets behind and pierces the veil. Now, why isn't that senator asking the right questions? Well, it could be that the senator doesn't want the right answer. The senator may be working with the witness to deceive. That happens all the time. Or it could be that the senator is an unskilled litigator. He's not a very skilled questioner. That happens all the time. All right, now let's go back here to our story. Lazarus. On cross-examination, Mr. Fuller, his accuser now, is going to be asked some questions. Question number one is this. Did you sign this application for employment? Answer, I did, sir. Question, did you swear to this application for employment? Answer, no, I did not swear to it. Question, let me show you your name signed on the bottom of this blank, and let me ask you if you signed that. Answer, yes, sir. Now he's uncovered his first lie. Now, this first lie may be inadvertent. It doesn't prove that he's a liar. But he answered the question incorrectly. Because the questioner, that is the attorney here on cross-examination, has a piece of paper in his hand. And he says, did you sign an application for employment when you got your job with the government? And he says, yes, I did. Well, was the application for employment an affidavit or a sworn statement? And he said, no, it wasn't. All right, here's his mistake as a witness. He had done this some time before. It may be that he didn't remember. But he answered the question, no, it was not. Did he know that it wasn't? Or was he trying to deceive by denying something that was true, but he didn't think that the investigator knew the answer? Now, here's a general rule. The rule is you never ask a question that you don't know the answer to. So, if I was the witness on the stand, I would presume that the interrogator asking me the question knows the answer. So, if he said, was the application that you signed? Now, keep in mind now that this application might have been signed a year or two before. Do you positively remember whether or not the piece of paper was a verified document? Verified. That is, do you remember whether or not it was a sworn document? You know, oftentimes you sign documents. Sometimes they're verified and sometimes they aren't. So the question is, well, was it verified? The correct answer would be, I don't know, I don't remember. Hillary Clinton's a marvel at bad memory. I don't know, I don't remember, I don't know. I don't remember. I don't know. I don't remember. So a trained witness, a trained litigator, would have answered the question correctly. I don't know. I don't remember. But by answering the question, no, it wasn't, you're saying to everybody that's listening, I remember, and no, it wasn't. Now the litigator, he hands you the document and says, listen to this. Let me show you your name signed on the bottom of this document and ask you if you signed that. Now the answer is, yes, sir, I signed it. And he says, question, do you see that it's sworn to? Answer, oh, I had forgotten it. All right, now score one for the litigator. And now the score is 1-0. It's innocuous, doesn't prove that he's a perjurer, but it casts suspicion now. The first notch of suspicion, hey, this guy's memory ain't near as good as he claims it is. He answered the question incorrectly. All right, so that's strike one. Then he asked the question, well, do you see a seal on it? Answer, I had forgotten that also. Question, this application appears to be subscribed on the 24th of May, 1918, by Charles Lawrence Fuller. Answer, it must be right if I've sworn to it on that date. Question, do you remember in May of 1918 that you signed and swore to this application? Answer, that is so. I must have sworn to it, sir. Question, well, do you remember it? Answer, well, let me look at it and I can probably refresh my memory. So the litigator hands the document to the witness. Now remember, he's sitting on the witness stand. He's got the paper in front of him. And now he's asked this question. Look at that signature. Does that help you? Answer, that is my signature. Question, then you said that. Do you remember in May of 1918, you signed and swore to this document? Answer, well, the date is there. Do you know that? Yes. Yes, sir, I must have sworn to it. I don't remember the date. Question, don't you remember that you signed your name Charles Lawrence Fuller there? I did, sir. And you swore to this paper and you signed it, didn't you? Answer. That date is correct there, sir, yes. Don't you remember you swore to it, the date you signed it? Answer. I swore to it. Question. Was your name Fuller? Answer. Yes, sir. Question. Has your name always been Fuller? Answer. No, sir. Question. What was your name? Boy, now we're starting to get somewhere, aren't we? Now, on May 18th here, the guy signs an affidavit. And then he signs it Charles Lawrence Fuller. And now the litigator gets out of his own lips. Has your name always been Fuller? No, sir. Hell, even his signature on the document now is a lie. Isn't it? Hey, now we got strike two. And we're just getting warmed up. Hang on, boys and girls. We got to take a break here and remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, The Law Hour and Editorial Review is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, it's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and that can also be accessed at the webpage. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports, reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. 67. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors and publications that we recommend and endorse are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management or staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Now, the book that we are reviewing here is called Wellman on Cross-Examination. Wellman, W-E-L-L-M-A-N, on Cross-Examination is the standard text for training lawyers in law school in cross-examination. You can probably get a copy of it from Dorset Press, probably Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble, your local bookstore. Now, I've got a hard copy here, and I think I paid $44 for it 20 years ago. I bought it from a legal bookstore, probably got it from, could be Westlaw or somebody like that, some legal publishing company. Well worth the $44, but I've had students tell me you can get it softbound, softcover, paperback, for about $6 or $8. It's a pretty thick book, 400-500 pages here. Let's see how many pages, 479 pages. So it pushes about 500 pages of material, and it has a number of these kinds of examinations in it so that you can learn how to do that, so that you can see what the standards are, what other attorneys have developed over the years, how F. Lee Bailey destroyed the testimony of Mark Furman in the O.J. Simpson case by using collateral matters as an illustration. Now, if you can't find it anywhere else, remember our old friends down here at the BraveNewBookstore.com. Anytime you got a book that you can't find, you know, some underground story over here, you know, that's not out there in the, you know, out there in the marketplace. It's BraveNewBookstore.com, or you can call them at 512-480-2503. Once more, that's 512-480-2503. All right, getting back here then to the matter at hand. The litigator now asks the policeman sitting on the witness stand the question, "Has your name always been Fuller?" And he said, "No, sir." "Well, then what was your name?" Now, the witness protested against any further inquiry along that line, but counsel was permitted to show that his name at one time was Finkler, and that he changed his name back and forth from Finkler to Fuller. Now, counsel then proceeded to bring the witness down to the actual oath that he had taken in his application. And he said, "Now, Mr. Fuller, in your application you made to the government, on which I show you your signature and your affidavit, you attached your picture, did you not?" Answer, "Yes, sir." Question, "And you stated in your application that you were born in Atlanta, Georgia, did you not?" Answer, "Yes, sir." And question, "You were asked when you sought this position these questions: when were you employed, the years and the months, and you wrote in February of 1897 to August of 1917, the number of years, 20. Now, where you were employed, Brooklyn, the name of your employer, the Vulcan Proofing Company, and the amount of salary, $37.50 a week, and also that you were the superintendent in the rubber and the compound room. Is that correct?" And Fuller answered, "Yes." "Yes, sir." And the question was, "You wrote that, didn't you, in your own handwriting? And you swore to that, didn't you?" And Fuller answered, "Yes, sir." Question, "Now, Mr. Fuller, were you employed from February of 1897 to August of 1917, a period of 20 years, with the Vulcan Proofing Company?" And Fuller's answer, "No, sir." Question, "That wasn't true, Mr. Fuller, was it?" Answer, "No, sir." Now, boys and girls, let's pause right here. This interrogator has now caught him lying three times. Out of his own mouth, he's been forced to admit that on his application for employment, that he's lied three times. He lied about his name, he lied about signing the sworn statement, and now he's lied about his employment history. And this is why it's called collateral matters, because the central theme of this prosecution is that Mr. Lazarus offered him bribes, and that Lazarus is turning out bad product and selling it to the government. That's the central issue. But the litigator isn't asking Mr. Lazarus. He doesn't have Lazarus on the stand. He's got his chief accuser on the stand, and he's attacking his chief accuser not concerning any testimony that he gave concerning the bribes or the bad quality product. the questions that he's asking have to do with his employment application, which is called a collateral matter, something that's totally off point, out of context, doesn't have anything to do with the case at hand. But we can do that on cross-examination because the exact purpose of cross-examination is to impeach his testimony, to show that this witness is not credible, that this witness is a liar. And that's what F. Lee Bailey did to Mark Furman. Over the N word. Do you remember that? So the use of collateral matters on cross-examination is a very important tool to learn to impeach the testimony, to impeach the credibility of a witness, a hostile witness. And this Mr. Fuller is certainly a hostile witness. He's already testified that Mr. Lazarus now, in this case, that Mr. Lazarus offered him bribes. Here's the policeman on the witness stand, lying. Now, can we uncover that lie? You bet we can. Is this guy's credibility, is his lying being uncovered? Absolutely. Right in front of everybody. Right out here in the open. Can you do that? You bet you can. Now, you need to understand, if this policeman comes in here and he's telling the truth, you're not going to uncover any lies. You're not going to uncover any false testimony. All this is designed to do, the Kwok Ting test now, is designed to uncover lies. How do we tell the truth? How do we know this guy is telling the truth? Now, we can uncover that. Now, judges are actually better fact finders than juries. My experience over the years, when I have a trial and I have to make the choice, well, should I have a jury trial? I almost invariably, I've had several jury trials, and they're typically bad news. And that's because for what I want to do in life, when I come into court to testify, I'm here testing some law. And typically, facts don't really come into the issue to any great degree. What we're talking about here is the law and the application of the law and how that law affects me and other people and the use of it and so on. And my experience tells me that judges are much better fact finders than juries. They're much more skillful. They have better understanding, better qualifications. Now, I've heard it reported by students, they come in here, oh, those judges are all dishonest. Oh, come on, let's be intelligent people here. All judges are dishonest? It's certainly true. There's going to be some dishonest judges out there. There's going to be some biased jurists. I don't doubt that. But my experience has told me that by and large, you know, that isn't true. By and large. And my experience with judges has been on the whole very positive. I've only met two judges that were total jerks, total incompetent boobs. Two, both of them state court judges, both of them here in Ozark County. Two hillbilly judges. Now, federal judges don't fall into that by any stretch of the imagination, and most state judges don't either. Most judges are pretty conscientious people, and then they're looking for the truth, and they know how to find it. And it is true that sometimes when judges get involved in politics, like Judge Mukasey and this Judge Gonzalez, you know, it turns their head. Judges ought not to be involved in politics. Politics is a lying chicanery to start with, and any judge that gets involved in politics will probably turn into, if he isn't already, he'll probably turn into a lying chicanery-filled judge or politician, whichever the case may be. But judges, by and large, are not involved in politics. They're involved in trying to determine, well, what happened here. They're involved in contracts. They're involved in the construction of the statute. How does that statute apply to us? And in that role, I don't find judges to be anywhere near what students and what lay people portray them to be. I don't know quite where that comes from. you know, you go into court and you get an adverse decision, did it ever occur to you that maybe you were guilty? Did it ever occur to you that maybe you were wrong? You know, it's a wild new concept. Now, in this case here, this guy Fuller is not only wrong, this guy is a lying perjurer. This guy is lying on his application. He's made a sworn statement. And this sworn statement's coming back to haunt him. So whenever you're signing a sworn statement, an affidavit, read it. Is that statement true? I'm not quite sure why Fuller lied about his past history. Maybe it was because he thought that if I lie on my application for employment, I'll get the job, and if I don't lie about my qualifications, I won't be able to get this job. Now, that may have been his motivation. And evidently, he didn't think about that when he decided to make good, when he decided to accuse this guy, Lazarus, of taking bribes. You know, one lie deserves another. And then the second lie deserves an even bigger, better third lie, and so on. Pretty soon, you're enmeshed in these lies and from which you cannot extricate yourself. And that's where this guy's headed. Now listen to this. And he said, and you had been the assistant superintendent of the rubber and compound room. Answer, no, sir. Question, that was false also, wasn't it? Answer, yes, sir. And through my experience as chief inspector of the rubber and slicker division, that was also a false statement, wasn't it, Mr. Fuller? And Fuller answered, yes, sir. And the litigator asks, and you knew that was false, didn't you? Yes, sir. And you knew you were swearing to a falsehood when you swore to it, didn't you? Yes, sir. And you swore to it intentionally? Yes, sir. And you knew you were committing perjury when you swore to it? Answer, well, I didn't look at it in that light. Question, didn't you know that you were committing perjury by swearing and pretending that you had been 20 years in this business? Answer, yes, sir. Listen to these lies being exposed. Just one after another. Question, and you're swearing now, aren't you, on the witness stand? You're swearing that your testimony is true, are you not? Yes, sir. Question, in a matter in which this man's liberty is involved, isn't it? Yes, sir. And you know that the jury is to be called upon to consider whether or not you're worthy of belief or not, don't you? Yes, sir. And when you swore to this falsehood deliberately, and you wrote it in your handwriting, you knew that it was false. You swore to it intentionally, and you knew that you were committing perjury, didn't you? Answer, well, I didn't look at it in that light. Well, now, Mr. Fuller, when you know that you're possibly swearing away the liberty of a citizen of this community, do you look at it in the same light? And he said, yes, sir, I do. Well, Mr. Littleton then uncovered the fact that the witness, instead of having been 20 years a superintendent of a rubber room with the Vulcan Proofing Company, as he had sworn to in his own handwriting, he was a stag entertainer in a questionable house. A stag entertainer in a whorehouse is what that boils down to. He was a barker at a Coney Island show. He was a barker at a carnival, and he was an advance agent of a cheap roadshow that had been published in the papers having drawn checks that were worthless. He also was a paper hanger writing bad checks. And the witness fully admitted all of the details of his 20 years of questionable transactions. The result was the total collapse so far as his credibility was concerned, and the government's case collapsed with him. Now, the point of the cross-examination and the design of the cross-examiner was to get the witness at the outset of his cross-examination into a position from which he could not possibly extricate himself by confronting him with this document written in his own handwriting, in which he would be obliged to admit that he had sworn falsely. The witness, having been thoroughly subjugated by this process, would then, as he actually did, confess to 20 years of gadding about in questionable employment under different names, and thus completely destroy himself as a reliable witness in the eyes of the jury. Now, you know, oftentimes lay people will say, well, how did the cross-examiner know that? He didn't. On discovery, he had to go find it. You know, before you go to trial, there's a period of time that we call discovery. And so the examiner in this case went to work. He did his homework. And he said, well, let's take the chief witness that the government has is a guy named Fuller. Let's go back to the beginning. Where does this Mr. Fuller come from? Who is he? What's his history? Well, let's go to the government. Here's a public document. His application for employment is a public document. No big secret about it. And so they went to the government and they said, okay, give us this information about this. Have you ever thought about, well, let's find out, where does this policeman come from? What's his history? What's his employment history? Is he a carnival barker who's now turned highway patrolman? Or is he an ex-MP from the Army who got out of the Army after having served in Vietnam or someplace? I mean, you know, most policemen have a pretty honorable record. But not all of them do. And here's a case. Now, this guy Fuller isn't a policeman per se, but he's a government inspector. A government inspector, like a meat inspector in a meat plant. I remember one time I had a student come in here, and he had been accused of, he was a meat company operator. He owned a meat packing plant. And he was accused of packing downer cows, that is, using downer cows in the school lunch program. And a government inspector was testifying against him. You know, things like that happen to this day. This isn't something that goes on back in World War I and then it's forgotten about. Hell, goes on day in and day out. Government employees are coming into court and testifying falsely. Government prosecutors are threatening and intimidating. You just saw it come down in Duke University. Normally, when a prosecutor threatens to put you in prison for 30 years and offers you a 5-year term, most people will plead guilty to something they didn't do to avoid being prosecuted and convicted and sent to prison for 30 years. Did you know that? Most will plead guilty to something they didn't do. I had a guy call here the other day, and he'd gone in and pled guilty. And he said, but I didn't do it. Well, then why did you plead guilty? Well, because they threatened to put me in jail for 15 years. Well, if I pled guilty, I could go to jail in a plea bargain agreement for 18 months, so I pled guilty. Well, okay. Then you were intimidated by the prosecutor and by the police. And if you can be intimidated that way, well, then go to jail. Shut up. But just because the police are threatening you and the prosecutor's threatening to put you in jail for 30 years doesn't mean he can do it. It means you have to come in here and show that they're lying about you. If they're sitting here saying, well, we're going to prove that you're a rapist, well, then you need to come in here and prove that you're not. You ever thought about cross-examining that woman and showing that she does not know and cannot recognize you? You know, there's 23 ways to do that, you guys that are being charged with rape. All you people now that are in prison charged with rape, your attorneys let you down. They did not prove that you were innocent. That is, you 30% that are innocent. They failed you. Now, it could be, as Jerry Spence pointed out, that the attorney that you hired simply lacked the capacity or the capability, the training, the experience, the knowledge of how to prove your innocence. That could well be the case. But here at the law school, we're not ignorant. I'm not telling you something here, you know, that only I know. Hell, there isn't anybody who is a competent litigator doesn't know how to impeach the testimony of a lying witness. What we can't do is we can't impeach the testimony of a witness that's telling the truth. Hell, I'd be the last guy to tell you that. You know, if you're guilty, I can't get somebody on the witness stand and prove that he's lying when he's telling the truth. That's why I mentioned to you, I said, the worst thing that can happen to you, partner, is that the witness is telling the truth about you. But if this guy comes in here and lies like this Fuller guy did, why, we can eat his lunch, and so can you. You can learn how to do this. And the best guy to do the cross-examination is the defendant. It's the defendant, and here's why. You know, whenever you think about this for a moment, whenever you hear a contradictory story, let's try it. You know, somebody tells you a story, and then somebody else tells you a story that contradicts the story that you heard. What's your first reaction? You disbelieve the first guy that told you the story, which gives rise to this old maxim or this old adage. It says, first liars don't have a chance. First liars don't have a chance. So when you come in and you tell your lawyer your story, he believes you. He comes into court, and the witnesses against you get on the witness stand, and they tell a contradictory story from yours. And you know what your lawyer's first reaction is going to be? Just human nature. He's going to disbelieve you. Oh, now it comes out, he says to himself. Oh, my God, my client over here lied to me in our interview in the office. You know, the one guy that really knows the truth about the testimony coming down is you, the defendant. You. You were there. Remember? You were the guy that was there. You know whether or not the policeman is telling the truth. And 75% of the time, the policeman's going to be telling the truth. And 25% of the time, he's going to be lying. You know the 25% that the policeman's lying. Your lawyer doesn't know. He doesn't know what part of the policeman's testimony is the lie and what part of it is the truth. But you do. That's why you're the best possible cross-examiner. You're the guy that can expose the policeman's lie because you know what the lie is and you can zero in on the lie. Your attorney, he's fishing. And he starts asking questions concerning the truth that the policeman is telling, and he can't get anywhere. The policeman isn't lying 100% of the time. He's only lying 25% of the time. That's only one out of four. And you know every single lie that the policeman is telling. And if you were trained, you have 23 tools to use to expose those lies, just like Fuller. Just like, could you show us how high you could raise your hand before the accident? And you throw it away and plead guilty to a crime you didn't commit because you've been intimidated by the police and the prosecutors. As old Shakespeare once said, oh, what tangled webs we weave when at first we seek to deceive. Well, I'm about out of time here, kids. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure you order one for yourself. And the number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Here, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night.